The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Let's start off with a little inspiration. Advice to the young. One of the world's most celebrated writers has much to share, though she sometimes wonders whether she keep her thoughts to herself, by Margaret Atwood. What advice would I give to the young? I have trouble answering this question. Here's why. Just before Christmas, I was in a cheese store, purchasing some cheese, when a very young man of, oh, say, between 40 and 50, I guess that's very young, entered in manifesting bewilderment. His wife had sent him out to get something called meringue sugar, with strict instructions to buy no other kind, and he didn't know what the stuff was, and he couldn't find it, and nobody in any of the shops he'd so far wandered into had any idea either. He didn't say this to me. He said it to the cheese shop person. She, too, appeared to be without a clue as to the meringue sugar mystery. None of this was of any concern of mine. I could have, and probably should have, simply pursued my own personal goal of cheese acquisition. Instead, I found myself saying, "Don't buy icing sugar. That isn't what your wife wants. What she probably wants is something like fruit sugar or berry sugar, which is sometimes called powdered sugar, but it isn't really powdered. It's a finer grind than ordinary white sugar, though you'll have a hard time finding it this time of year. But really, ordinary white sugar works just fine for meringues as long as you beat it in very slowly. I use it all the time myself, and it helps if you add just a tiny bit of cream of tartar and maybe half a teaspoon of white vinegar and," at this point, my daughter, who had succeeded in identifying the required cheese, got me in a hammerlock and dragged me over to the cash register where a line was building. "The white vinegar, not the brown," I called in closing. But I was already appalled at myself. Why had I spewed out all this unasked-for advice to a complete stranger, albeit a helpless and confused one? It's an age thing. And there's a hormone in the brain that kicks in when you see a younger person in a state of shell shock over meringue sugar, or how to get the lids off jars, or the beet stains out of tablecloths, or the right way of dumping the bad boyfriend who should be disposed of immediately because, as anyone with half a wit can see, the man is a psychopath, or which candidate is best bet in the local election, or any number of other things on which you appear to yourself to have an overflowing fund of useful knowledge that may vanish from the planet unless you dish it right and left on the spot to those in need. This hormone automatically takes over, like the hormone in a mother robin that forces her to cram worms and grubs down the gaping maws of plainly cheaply nestlings, and reams of helpful hints unscroll out of your mouth like a runaway roll of toilet paper falling down the stairs. You have no way of stopping this process. It just happens. It's been happening for centuries. No, for millennia. Ever since we developed what is loosely called human culture. The young have been on the receiving end of instructions from their elders, whether they liked it or not. Where are the best roots and berries? How do you make an arrowhead? What fish are plentiful? Where and when? Which mushrooms are poisonous? The instruction must have taken pleasant forms. "Great arrowhead. Now try it this way." Or unpleasant ones. "You idiot! That's no way to skin a mastodon. Do it like this." Since we've still got the same hardware as Cro-Magnon Man, or so we're told, it's merely the details that have changed, not the process. Hands up, everyone who's ever taped laundry instructions to the washer-dryer for the benefit of their teenage kids. Hands up. There are mountains of self-help books testifying to the fact that the young, and not only the young, are fond of securing advice in every possible subject, from how to get rid of pimples to the suave way of maneuvering some youth with commitment issues into marriage, to the management of colic in infants, to the making of the perfect waffle, to the negotiation of an improved salary, to the purchase of a rewarding retirement property, to the planning of a really knockout funeral. The cookbook is one of the easiest forms of self-help books. Mrs. Isabella Beaton's enormous 19th-century tome, The Book of Household Management, expands her tradition and includes not only recipes, but advice on everything from how to tell a real fainting fit from a sham one, to the proper color choices for blondes and brunettes, to which topics or conversations are safe for afternoon visits, stay away from religious controversy, the weather is always acceptable. Martha Stewart, Ann Landers, and Miss Manners are Miss Beaton's great-great-granddaughters, as is Mrs. Rombauer Becker of the Joy of Cooking fame, and every home handyman, interior decorator, and sex expert you've watched on television. Look at the shows and read the books and authors quickly in sequence, and you'll find the need of some cotton wool to stuff in your ears as a defense against the endless stream of what sound like relentless finger-waving, hectoring, and nagging if you hadn't chosen to let those folks in the door yourself. With how-to books and self-help shows, you can absorb the advice and when you want it, but friends or acquaintance or relatives, especially mothers, cannot be so easily opened and then closed and put back on the shelf. Over the centuries, novels and plays have given us the stock character, the older female or male, both versions exist, who's a voluble, interfering busybody, deluging the young folk on the with unasked-for tips on how to conduct their lives, coupled with shark-tongued criticisms when the advice is not heeded. Mrs. Rachel Lynde in Anne of Green Gables is a case in point. Sometimes this type of person will have a good heart. Mrs. Lynde does. Although, just as often, he or she will be a sinister control freak like the Queen of Night in Mozart's The Magic Flute. But good or bad, the meddlesome busybody is seldom entirely sympathetic. Why? Because we like other people, well-meaning or not, to mind their own darn business, not ours. Even helpful advice can be indistinguishable from bossiness when you're on the receiving end. My own mother was of the non-interference school unless it was a matter of life and death. If we children were doing something truly dangerous, and she knew about it, she would stop us. Otherwise, she let us learn by experience. Less work for her, come to think about it, though there was, of course, the work of self-restraint. She later said that she had to leave the kitchen when I was making my first pie crust. The sight was so painful to her. I've come to appreciate these silences of my mother's, though she could always produce a condensed pill of sensible advice when asked for it. All the more puzzling, then, that I have taken to blurting out instructions to strangers in cheese stores. Perhaps I take after my father, who was relentlessly informative, though he always tempered the force of his utterances by beginning, "As I'm sure you know." I went to high school at a time when students were required to learn things off by heart. This work formed part of the exam. You were expected not only to recite the set pieces out loud, but also to regurgitate them onto the page, with marks off for faults in spelling. One standard item was a speech made by in Hamlet by the old court counselor Polonius to his son Laertes, who is departing for a trip to France. Here's the speech, in case you may have forgotten it, as I found I had when I tried out for total recall. "Yet here, Laertes? Aboard? Aboard, for shame! The wind sits on the shoulder of your sail, and you are to stay for there, my blessings with thee. And with these few precepts in thy memory, look thou character, give thy thoughts no tongue, nor any unportioned thought this act. Be thou familiar, but no means vulgar. Those friends thou hast in their adoption tried. Grapple them unto thy soul with hoops of steel, but do not dull thy palm with entertainment. Of each new-hatched unfledged comrade, beware of entrance to a quarrel, but being in, bear that the opposed may beware of thee. Give every man thine ear, but few thy voice. Take each man's censure, but reserve thy judgment. Costly thy habit as thy purse can buy, but not expressed in fancy rich, not gaudy. For the apparel oft proclaims the man, and they in France of the best rank and station are most select and generous chief in that. Neither a borrow nor a lender be, for a loan oft loses both itself and the friend. And borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thus canst then be false to any man. Farewell, my blessing season, this in thee. The method is aggressive. Polonius scolds Laertes because he isn't on the ship yet, then holds him back with a long list of do's and don'ts. But it's all very good advice. A rational person can't disagree with any of it. Yet in every performance of Hamlet I've ever seen, Polonius is played as a comical but tedious old pedant, and Laertes listens to him with barely concealed impatience, although he himself has just dished out a heaping plateful of his own advice to his younger sister Ophelia. Look at objectively, Polonius can't really have been the boring idiot we're usually shown. He's chief advisor to Claudius, who's a villain but no fool. Claudius wouldn't have kept Polonius around if the latter had really been several blocks bricks short of a load. Why then is the scene always played this way? One reason is that it would be boring if done straight, because advice you haven't asked for is always boring, and it's especially boring if the person giving the advice is old, and you yourself are young. It's like the cartoon with the caption, What we say to cats, what they hear. Over the head of the cat is a voice balloon with nothing in it. Our advice to the cat may be perfectly good. Don't mess with that big calm cat down the street. But the cat isn't receptive. It will follow its own counsel because that's what cats do. And that's what young people do as well, unless there's something specific they want you to tell them. Which is my way of ducking the question. What advice would I give to the young? None, unless they ask for it. Or that's what would happen in the ideal world, in the world I actually inhabit. I break this virtuous rule daily. Since it's the slightest excuse, I find myself blathering on about all kinds of things due to the Bubba Robin hormone I've already mentioned. Thus, as I'm sure you know, the most eco-friendly toilet is the Caroma, and you can state your position and stick to your guns without being rude. Awnings cut down on summer heat through your windows by 70% or more. If you want to work or be a novelist, do back exercise daily. You'll need them later. Don't phone him. Let him phone you. Think globally. Act locally. After having a baby, you lose your brain and some of your hair, but they both grow back. A stitch in time saves nine. There's a kind of crampon you can strap on your boots, handy on icy sidewalks. Don't stick a fork into a wall socket. If you don't clean the lint trap on the dryer, it may burst into flames. If the hair on your arm stands up in a thunderstorm, jump. Don't step into a canoe when it's pulled up on the beach. Never let anyone pour you a drink in a bar. Sometimes the only way out is through. In the northern forest, hang your food from a tree some distance from your sleeping area, and don't wear perfume. This above all, to thine own self be true. Highbrow tweezers are handy for getting big wads of glop out of bathroom sink drains. Every household should contain a windpipe, wind-up flashlight. And don't forget about the little touch of vinegar for the meringues. That's the white vinegar, not the brown. However, the best place of advice of all. Sometimes young people don't want advice from their elders. They don't wish you to turn into Polonia. Not as such. They can do without the main body of the speech, the long checklist of instructions. But they welcome the part of the end, which is kind of a benediction. Farewell. My blessing season in this in thee. If they want you to see them off on their voyage, after all, which is, a voyage they have to make on their own. Maybe it will be dangerous voyage. Maybe you'll be able to handle the danger better than they will. But you can't do it for them. You've got to stay behind, waving encouragingly, anxiously, a little plainfully, farewell, farewell. But they do want the goodwill from you. They want that blessing. National interest. I never thought of it that way. How to talk to people, even if you disagree. Oh, boy, does that this hit a good note here. If there's one thing most people can agree on, it's that the way we treat and talk to people with opposing views is broken. We can't stomach the ideas from across the political divide, let alone the people who hold them. This goes for other polarizing topics, too, not just politics. In one 2021 poll, most Americans thought the biggest threat to our country's way of life was other people in America. That's in quotation marks. By June 2021, U.S. voters rated division in the country as the number one issue facing them personally. Whether you consider yourself conservative, liberal, or something in between, or something off that spectrum altogether, I bet you've wondered, as I have, how long we can hold it together while our differences threaten to wreck our relationships, our country, and our ability to share our lives, really, at all. Take poor Barbara in Knoxville, Tennessee, a mother of five grown men whose families got so fired up clashing over politics at her 2017 Thanksgiving dinner, she told me. It was like a bomb went off. One of her sons is very conservative. Another is very liberal. A third and fourth moderately conservative and liberal, respectively, and a fifth is more centrist. Yes, really. I think they find me as a microcosm of the country, says Barbara, who described herself as a conservative libertarian Christian. She tried to keep the peace that holiday, begging, "Can't we just have a nice family dinner?" Instead of some family members wound up leaving early while at least one daughter-in-law ended up in tears. Barbara and I connected through our shared determination to find some answers to the challenges these dangerous divided times present in our lives. This is important to me because I work for a group whose mission is to do just that. Braver Angels is the nation's largest cross-partisan grassroots organization working to depolarize America. I am also a Mexican immigrant and the proud liberal daughter of conservative parents. I voted for Joe Biden. Mom and Dad voted for Donald Trump. Each story I hear from Americans of all stripes about the ways that our divides are pulling them apart, the fallings out, the declined invitations, the tweet storms, all of the ways that people are no longer speaking to people, brings me face to face with one question. Why am I still speaking to them? Even after the tense, three-hour conversation about race and law enforcement with Mom, where neither of us changed our minds, even after the two-hour argument with Dad about how the White House handled the coronavirus pandemic, where I definitely went too far and he was about as mad as I've ever seen him, even after all that and more, why am I not only speaking to my parents, but listening to them, learning from them, and enjoying their company? Why am I both eager and afraid to tell my fellow Seattle liberals that I not only speak to my parents, but I understand them, that if I were them, I would have voted for Donald Trump, too? I hear people say the answer to all this division is more education and information, but trustworthy information, not that other junk. I hear them say the answer is persuasion, that no conversation is worth having with people who disagree with you if you're not challenging their ideas and trying to show them where they're wrong. I hear them say the answer is simple action. Stop yammering and do something to build a more sensible world, ignoring or defeating whoever's standing in your way. I say an answer, though. It might include all these things. Won't give us what we need. What we need are more questions. As a journalist, I've asked a lot of those. I used to be awful at it. I still remember my terror as a kid the day my mom made me march up to the cashier at Burger King and ask for another packet of salt. What if I sounded stupid? Took all my courage at first newspaper internship just to pick up the phone and call strangers. My heart would stop when I heard their voices. But then I fell in love with what they could show me. Given the chance to ask anything I wanted about who people are, what they do, or what they think, I realized what for years I've been too petrified to notice. Everybody is so interesting. I stopped being afraid to ask questions. I stopped being too impatient to hear the answers. Soon I developed an incurable addiction to people, our stories, our passions, the totally unique way we each of us sees the world, and to converse, to the conversation itself, that unpredictable meeting of the minds where individuals with widely differing lives can surprise, delight, and ultimately learn from each other. One of my favorite questions to ask in an interview is, why you? Why did you start a church in a bar? Why did you become your community's most beloved nurse? Or decide to study crows for a living, and not, you know, somebody else? So I guess I should answer that question for myself. Why did I write a book about how to stay curious across divides? And why should you listen to what I have to say about talking to people you disagree with? If I can sum up the work I've done for my 17 years of listening to people professionally, I'd say it's been one big evolving experiment on how we can better understand each other. I don't do it for fun, although it's most fun I've ever had. I do it because connecting with other humans is what makes our lives rich and meaningful, especially when so much can pull us apart. In her book, The Happiness Hack, my friend, neuroscience educator Ellen Petrie Lenz, explains what happens to your brain when you spend a lot of time with folks who reflect your own beliefs back to you. Basically, you stop thinking about those beliefs at all. Your brain likes to stay efficient, take shortcuts, save cognitive power. So as you become entrenched in your beliefs, your brain moves them to a part of itself that's good at automatic, reactive thinking, and away from the part that reasons things out. 'Cause who has the time? As a result, you react to competing beliefs the way you'd react to anything that seems totally unnatural or wrong, with disgust and repulsion. Our life experience is shaped by our assumptions, bias, and blind spots, Lenz told me. We think it's a reality, yet it's only conditioned perception that we have been taught is truth. This is great news for groups that are battling it out over their beliefs. Nobody wants soldiers to question whether a threat is a threat. They want them in a fray, sure enough, of the cause to hit fast and hard at every opportunity. But if you stop considering other points of view, if even your brain wants you locked in where you're comfortable, how can you be sure that the group battles you're waging are justified? And what if you want just to sit at a table and enjoy your family, regardless of what they believe? Coming to the field of journalism, I feel as if I'm supposed to be rah-rah for information as the cure for everything. But I'm not. I'm tired of us throwing out links and throwing up our hands, ranting to our people who get it while raging at those people who don't. I'm done, too, going along with the idea that if we could just get rid of the word misinformation, everything would be fine. As if mowing down weeds would keep the new ones from sprouting. False stories soar because good people relate to something in them that's true. A fear or a value or a concern that's going unheard, unexplored, or unacknowledged at the time. Every time. One of the best ways to meet people where they are is to ask them where they've been. What paths have they walked to get to where they are? What have they seen along the way? That changes their landscape, shifts their perspective. Think of the phrases we use almost automatically when some piece of understanding lands with us. I see where you're coming from. I know where you are. I'm there with you. To get from Seattle, Washington, to Sherman County, Oregon, you drive east over Lake Washington, up and over the Snoqualmie Pass, where yours might pop, then south, watching mountains give way to quiet hills and plains. You pass the Columbia River into Oregon, past Biggs Junction and Wasco, then land at Morrow, the county seat, population 353. Those 250 miles took about 5 hours to cover one Saturday morning in March 2017, when about 20 of us from Seattle area made our way toward the Oregon State University Extension office. Inside, 16 residents of Sherman County were waiting, a bit uneasy, to meet and talk with these urban visitors about the political divisions gripping the country. Most of them had voted for Donald Trump. The travelers from Seattle's King County also wondered and worried about what the day would hold. Most of them had voted for Hillary Clinton. Our visit would begin with a brief bus tour. Just 1,705 people lived on Sherman County's 831 square miles, and much of that landscape is wheat fields, a bright carpet of beige under the day's sunny sky. What would happen here today that would leave you feeling like this was a good investment of your time? It was the opening question of the questionnaire I'd helped prepare for the event. If I closed my eyes, I wouldn't have been able to tell which answers came from which county. Having a talk with real people instead of all that angry yelling on Facebook. Getting to know people who don't live like me and don't think like me. Just learning something that helps me understand a bit better why we're all so different. Because maybe we're not different as we think. People from the different counties paired off to ask each other questions and listen, without interruption, to the answers. After several rounds of pairings, the room buzzing with tense energy, we brought the big group back together for people to share their thoughts. I'll never forget when Darren Padgett stood up, all 6'9" of him. Padgett is a fourth-generation wheat farmer at a time when the average American is 4 generations removed from anything approaching that lifestyle. He took a deep breath and gazed at the bits of sandwich crust scattered on the tables from lunch. "If you knew," he said in a deep, gruff voice, "what it took to get that simple sandwich on your plate." Economic reasons, Patton said, led him to vote for Trump. His health care costs have jumped 426% in the past few years, and regulations like the Waters of the United States rule were threatening his business. "That's right," another farmer said. People from Sherman County nodded while people from King County thought, "What the heck is the Waters of the United States rule?" Turns out the rule defines what bodies of water fall under federal regulation, and it's a big deal. Farmers for years have been nervous about how the rule might be interpreted to cover small, seasonal, rain-made ponds. The rules are complex and confusing, and many of the farmers thought they could better trust Republicans, including the businessman America had elected president, to address their concerns. The tale was an "I never thought of it that way" moment for Seattle resident Laura Caspi. It did enter my consciousness that they voted that way for reasons I hadn't even considered, or for reasons that didn't matter to me, he said. Our lives are so different. My favorite photo taking that day was of Caspi and a Sherman County farmer named Fred. In it, they're giving each other a high five at the end of their conversation. Caspi with blue-tipped hair, Fred with a cowboy hat. She'd been afraid that it would be tough to make this bridge to people who looked at the world so differently, even for a short couple of hours. The topics were difficult and tense, but it wasn't hard to talk, and that gave her some hope. "I felt like his granddaughter," she said. When our time together was done, nobody wanted to leave. People kept chatting in the conference room and hallways by the reception desk, and outside under a big sky and a bit of March sun, people traded contact information. Many good things would follow from this event, which we had titled Melting Mountains and Urban Rural Gathering. Some people kept it in touch, considering their continuing their conversation over email. Liberals and conservatives from around the country would reach out to my partners and me about doing something like it in their states. The trip will be featured in case studies, conferences, and articles. We'd start out with a mountain of assumptions to melt, and while we were pretending one afternoon is all it took, we showed we could at least get started. At my parents' place on Election Day 2020, the three of us watched the results of the presidential race stream in on Fox News, then CNN, then back and forth for hours. We had our first shouting match about immigration over sips of the sangrias mob mixed. We had a bigger one about race late into the night, with me standing cross-armed in front of the TV, Mom taking my side for a fun hot second, and usually reserved Daddy leaned forward his recliner, his voice booming. "You know, Monica," he'd said to me in Spanish earlier that day, "I've heard that some people who don't share their parents' politics, they stop letting them see their grandkids, and I've wondered if that'll ever happen to us." I have two kids, now 8 and 6 years old, and they see their grandparents all the time. My dad's written songs for them, songs he plays on his guitar and they memorize, then launch into singing at full volume from the back seat of my Altima. I didn't hesitate. "Yama," I told Dad. "Never. That'll never happen, Dad. That'll never, ever happen to us." After all the night's results had been reported, we had one more political clash about, well, who knows what it was about. I was sitting at their kitchen island eating butter pecan ice cream. Mom had served me in the same little gray Tupperware cups I'd used as a kid. By the last bite, Mom had changed into her long red nightshirt. She sat down next to me, patted my hand, and said she was glad I'd come. I was glad I'd come, too. Neither of us knew who would win, whose views would be hold sway in the months and years to come. But I was grateful for that moment, at least. It didn't matter. Building a bridge to other side isn't easy, but it's also likely that it's not as hard as you think. Take the first step out of your silo, and the gulf you've been afraid to span might look like more like a gap and feel more like an invitation. I guarantee that when you are more and more genuinely curious, it will strengthen all the relationships that matter to you, whether with your relatives, your colleagues, your country, or yourself. So here's your mission. Should you choose to accept it, surprise yourself. Take one step closer to someone who disagrees with you, whether that means spending time with a friend or relative you've been drifting apart from, reading an opinion from earnest voices on the other side, or sparking a conversation that you've been both eager and hesitant to have. When you want to explore why they're wrong, explore instead what you're missing. When you want to determine whose view wins, determine what makes each view understandable. When you want to discover why someone believes something that confounds you, discover how they came to believe it. When you want to know what their problem is, try to know what their concerns are. When you want to demand why they won't care about what you care about, learn what they care about more. When you want to trap them into saying what you want to hear, free them so they can say what they honestly mean. And when you want to stop listening so you can react or respond or judge, which will be often, mind the gap between what you know and what you most certainly don't, and ask one more curious question. More often than you probably think, you might just find yourself saying, "I never thought of it that way." Now from Consumer Reports, the remedy for big medical bills. As the cost of care rises, even insured people can be on the hook for huge health care expenses. But there are ways to save before you seek treatment and after. While more people in the U.S. have health insurance than ever, more than 90%, medical debt is a problem that has not gone away. In fact, the reverse is true. Americans have more medical debt in collections, at least $140 billion, than all other types combined, according to a 2021 analysis in the Journal of American Medical Association. That's up from the $81 million a different study found in 2016. And almost 1 in 5 households has medical debt, owing a median of $2,000, according to the 2017 U.S. Census Bureau data. For people with health insurance, high deductibles and copays are a main cause. Another, the cost of health care has risen dramatically in the last 10 years, says Chuck Bell, senior policy analyst at Consumer Reports. Every year, people have to reach deeper into their pockets to afford care, leaving many with big unpaid bills. One reflection of the problem is the high number of people reporting issues with medical debt to Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's complaint database. A Utah resident, for example, wrote that a growing stack of medical bills led to late mortgage payments. Another from Florida said the debt hurt their credit score. It was only when my health began failing and I began accruing medical bills that I started finding behind on my bills, wrote a third from Louisiana. You might think older Americans, typically covered by Medicare, are spared the problem, but that's not the case. In about 1 in 10 households, excuse me, I have to turn the page, led by someone 65 or older has medical debt, according to a 2019 U.S. Census study. And a 2010 study of people 70 and older found that out-of-pocket medical expenses in the 5 years prior to their average death, their death averaged more than $38,000. That number is almost certainly higher today. Good example, I just spent $70 for eardrops for an ear infection. Almost half of all seniors live on a fixed income of less than $26,000, and many have less than $15,000 in savings, said Frederick Ricardi, president of Medicare Rights Center, a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. Medical bills can lead older people to skip buying groceries, delay rent or mortgage payments, or forgo paying utility bills, he says. With these problems faced disproportionately by older Black and Latino people, some even fail to get needed medical care. Older people generally face greater health challenges and thus higher medical expenses, says CR's Bell. Even if you're on Medicare, you can get snagged in a web of complicated billing and coverage problems. When those bills wind up in collections, the repercussions can far-reach you because the debt can hurt your credit score. But having unpaid medical bills should no longer put your credit score at risk. Starting July 1st, the big three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, will change how they handle medical debt on credit reports. Medical debt that has been paid will be removed from credit reports, and medical bills reported to credit agency won't be added to a report for 12 months versus the current 6 months, long enough for people to work out payment. Beginning in 2023, any unpaid medical bill of $500 or less won't be added to any person's credit report. These changes will help millions, Bell says, but sadly, the problem of high medical costs won't be so easily erased. Here we explain the ways to guard against getting high medical bills in the first place and what to do if you still end up with one. Get ahead of big bills. A little planning can go a long way toward keeping costs under control. Know the cost up front. A new law gives people without insurance the right to a good faith estimate of charges prior to a planned procedure or test. But there's nothing that stops even people with insurance from asking for that information, says Patricia Kilmore, a health policy advocate of the USPRIG, Public Interest Research Group, a consumer advocacy organization. Share that estimate, which includes everything planned for your medical care, with your insurer. This way you can find out what is covered, how well, and what you may be expected to pay out of pocket. Speak up at the doctor's office. More people report being afraid of high medical bills and being afraid of becoming ill, according to a 2019 study from the CFPB. Yet many are also afraid to discuss the cost concerns with their doctors, says Caitlin Donovan, a healthcare policy expert at the Patient Advocate Foundation, which helps consumers with medical bills. Such a conversation could prompt your doctor to find ways to trim expenses. She says, for example, by prescribing less expensive medications or limiting office visits. But they won't know cost is an issue unless you bring it up. Make sure your provider has all your insurance information. You could have two, three, or possibly more types of insurance that could be applied to different aspects of your care. For example, you could have insurance through your employer and also be covered under your spouse's plan. Or you may use traditional Medicare, a supplemental plan, and a Part D drug benefit. Busy doctor's offices and the complexity of insurance can mean information about one or more of those plans doesn't make it onto your record. Confirm with all your providers that your insurance profile and their system is complete, Donovan says. If you're on Medicare, considering buying supplemental insurance. Traditional Medicare, Part A for hospital and Part B for other medical care, is what most people sign up for when they turn 65. In addition to premiums, with these plans, you are also responsible for deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance. To help with those costs, private companies offer coverage known as Medicare Supplement Insurance, or Medigap, which can run about $150 per month, says Jack Hoadley, Ph.D., research professor emeritus at the Health Policy Institute at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Supplemental plans cover most of the costs traditional Medicare doesn't, including the 20% you'd have to pay for physicians' bills, Hadley says. About 1 in 5 beneficiaries of traditional Medicare had no supplemental coverage in 2018, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. For seniors, it's really the biggest piece of the puzzle, avoiding large medical bills. Good to know. It's important to sign up for Medicare supplement coverage when you are first become eligible, Hadley says. During the initial enrollment period, your application may be accepted regardless of your health status. After that, you're likely to be asked to get a health screening and could be denied coverage or charged more based on your conditions. Or consider Medicare Advantage. If you can't afford a supplemental plan, this might be a less expensive option. Advantage covers plans. Managed plans cover parts A and B and sometimes D, and can cover some of the out-of-pocket costs that traditional Medicare doesn't. Some charge no additional premium beyond what you already pay for Part B. But because Advantage plans are offered by private companies that are contract with Medicare, the network of doctors who take it usually smaller and can change every year. It can be a great deal if your doctors participate in the network, Hadley says. Typical plans cover drugs and some dental, vision, and hearing care, and sometimes even extra perks such as gym memberships, and have good coverage for everything else after your deductible is met. Deductibles can be $0 to several $100 depending on the plan. Good to know. You can sign up for an Advantage plan around the same time you turn 65, regardless of your health status. But if you decide to later switch to traditional Medicare, you may need a health screening for a supplemental plan to go with it, unless, for example, you moved out of state or your Advantage plan left the market. See whether you qualify for a Medicare savings program. People with limited income and few assets beyond a home and a car could qualify to have deductibles, premiums, coinsurance, and copayments covered, depending on the state in which they live. To find out, get contact information from your state Medicare office at medicare.gov/talk-to-someone. Select your state from the drop-down menu. It's possible, too, that you may qualify for Medicaid, especially because most states have expanded eligibility requirements so that coverage isn't limited to those living at or below the poverty level. What to do if bills pile up? You can take all the right steps and get a big medical bill, of course. To keep financial trouble at bay, try the following. Never automatically pay a hospital or provider bill. That's because a doctor's office or other facility should first send their invoice directly to insurance, Medicare, Supplemental Medicare, Medicare Advantage, or private insurer to see how much of a bill will be covered, Donovan says. If you have insurance and get a bill from a hospital or a doctor, contact the provider and make sure the bill was submitted to your insurance company. Once it has been, your insurance will send you a summary notice or an explanation of benefits that shows any remaining amount owed. Make sure the bill is correct. Almost half of all medical bills contain at least one error, including duplicate charges or charges for services you never received, Donovan says. If you face a high bill and are off the hook for some portion of it, request a bill itemizing everything you were charged for and go through it line by line, she says. Find something, dispute any charges that shouldn't be there with the provider. Dispute charges related to Medicare medical errors. Say you developed an infection in the hospital after having your knee replaced. At the very best, you should challenge any extra charge for needed to treat that infection. You could even consider asking about a discount for the original procedure, particularly if the error caused you to miss work or triggered another financial harm. There's no guarantee that even the extra charge will be forgiven or discounted, Donovan says, but it's certainly worth a try. Ask about a hospital's financial assistance programs. Nonprofit hospitals must, by law, provide financial assistance. Some states, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Nevada, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, and Washington, require all hospitals to offer discounted or free care to many people with low incomes, even if you live in another state. There's no shame in asking for financial help, Donovan says. The CFPB's most recent report on medical debt found that hospitals didn't always let patients know financial assistance was available unless they asked. And a 2019 Kaiser Health News analyst found that almost half of nonprofit hospitals billed the patients who would have qualified for free or discounted care. Negotiated. It's in the provider's interest to work with you to obtain payment. So determine what the amount per month that you can reasonably pay after accounting for housing, food, fuel, and other necessities. Also ask that no interest be charged. Or if you have the funds, you can offer a one-time payment for a reduced total bill, she says. Doing so can save you 15% or more. Get help. Free assistance is abundant. The Medicare Right Center, for one, can walk you through the process of choosing among types of Medicare plans. Contact the center weekdays during business hours at MedicareRights.org or 800-333-4114. Another option, state health insurance assistance programs, which are operated by qualified staff and volunteers to help you wade through all the Medicare choices in your state. They can also connect you with your state Medicaid office, says Hadley, who volunteers in the state of Virginia. Find your state's contact info at the shiphelp.com. Need a hand understanding and negotiating your medical bills? For many, the Patient Advocate Foundation provides those services and more, free of charge. Contact the organization at patientadvocate.org or 800-532-5272. Considering hiring an advocate, look for medical billing specialists through the Alliance of Professional Health Advocates at advoconnection.com. Then check to make sure that the specialty you find has credentials from the Patient Advocate Certification Board at pacboard.org/bcpa-certificate-list. Insurance won't cover? Here's how to appeal. Whichever type of health insurance you carry, you have the right to challenge denials of health care claims, says Caitlin Donovan, health policy expert at the Patient Advocate Foundation. If you sought pre-authorization for a health care service and were denied that, you can also appeal that decision. Mistakes can happen at multiple points in the claim filing or pre-authorization process, so the first step is to phone your insurers to make sure the decision was not made in error. If it was not, ask to speak to the reviewer behind the decision and request an explanation for the denial. Keep notes because you'll need this information in writing later, Donovan says. The second step is to file a formal appeal. Enlist your doctor's help to write a letter that explains the necessity of the procedure and includes supporting documents such as your medical records and studies about the treatment. State your case for why you disagree with the decision to deny, Donovan says. It should take about 30 days or longer. It could take about 30 days or longer to get a response. For a test, drug, or procedure you haven't yet received, you can ask for an expedited review. If the insurance determination is to stand by the denial, both Medicare and private insurance must by law state the reason in writing and tell you how to appeal the decision with an independent third party. If you're dealing with Medicare, there are three additional actions you can take, eventually leading to a hearing before a judge. Consider getting legal help for any of them. If you get your insurance through your employer, your company's human resources department may be able to help. Ask the department to reconsider the denial and say why you think it should. Why you shouldn't pay your medical bills with a credit card. When it comes to paying a bill you can't cover with money in your checking account, reaching for your credit card can be automatic. But there are serious reasons to think twice about doing that for medical bills, says Patricia Kelmore, a health policy advocate at the USPRIG, a consumer advocacy organization. The first is that you could wind up paying interest on a balance owed after 30 days, which, depending on the size of the debt and how long it takes you to pay it off, could cost you hundreds or thousands of dollars extra. That compares with payment plans that some hospitals or health care providers can arrange that might charge low or no interest, Kelmore says. And she says those will likely let you set the amount that you can afford to pay each month. Second, paying a medical bill with a credit card means it will be treated like any other debt if it goes unpaid, she says. It can wind up in the collections and be reported on your credit report, potentially lowering your score because it is a credit card debt and not a medical debt. It can remain in your report for up to 7 years, even after it has been paid. On the other hand, any payment plan negotiated with a hospital or doctor's office will stay off your report altogether if you pay it off. If there is a billing or payment problem, you'll have 12 months to resolve it before the debt appears on your credit report. Now, while many of my listeners do not drive because they are unable to see well enough to do so, they do have people with them who drive and family members and such. So oftentimes I'll read stuff in Consumer Reports about automobiles because I think it's important for you to know so you can advise or even have those people listen to these articles to get a better idea of things about the cars that they use. And this article is Find a Great Used Car You'll Love. We highlight the most reliable brands and top models to look for, plus give you tips on how to make sure you're getting a good deal. Shopping the used car market can be tricky right now. Global supply chain issues affecting the pricing and availability of new cars have also made it harder to find good used models at affordable prices. But with a little patience and research, you can find a safe and reliable vehicle that fits your needs and priorities. Our used car recommendations are based on testing from our experts, along with reliability survey results that will help you find models from the brands least likely to let you down. We focused on 5-year-old vehicles because depreciation makes them more affordable than newer used cars. But they're new enough to have important active safety features, such as forward collision warning, automatic emergency braking, and blind spot warning. We assess the reliability of brands for used vehicles, knowing that you can feel more confident about your purchase if it comes from a dependable brand you can trust. Then we highlighted a model recommended by CR from each of the top brands listed and did some checking around to make sure the models were available. We also pointed out other reliable years to consider. The good news is that there are a variety of safe and reliable used car choices out there, says Jake Fisher, CR Senior Director of Auto Testing. We picked an assortment of car types from the most reliable brands, including a few that just might be off your radar. Fuel economy. Check out our ratings at cr.org/carsatoz to see if the used model you like fares well against other in its classes. Reliability score. This indicates how a vehicle's overall problem rate compares with other models from the same year, based on the survey response from CR members about their cars. Satisfaction score. CR members tell us each year whether they'd buy their same car again if given the chance. We calculate a score for each model based on those surveys' responses. Safety systems. FCW and AEB are available on older models, but we're not offering standard. So before you borrow, make sure your used car choice has these life-saving safety features. Most reliable brands for 5-year-old vehicles. Our brand ratings charts show that it's hard to go wrong with any Lexus or Toyota. All of their 5-year-old models have above average reliability. The average reliability scores include all models for which we had sufficient survey data for the brand. With variety in mind, we've highlighted 8 models from our list for the top reliable brands for the 2017 model year. Number of 2017 models Lexus has is 5, and they got it. They're the number. I'll run them down by ranking. They got 91. Toyota has 12 models, 84 ranking. Acura has 2 models, got 81 ranking. Infiniti, Mercedes-Benz, Nissan, Buick, and Mazda, and Lincoln, anywhere from 77 down to 61 numbers. Lincoln, Volkswagen, Honda, Subaru, Tesla, Kia, BMW, all got in the 50s. Audi's got 49s. Volvo and Ford also got in the 40s. Hyundai, Jeep, Chevrolet, Ram, and GMC got in low 30s to the low 20s. The 2017 Lexus RX, from 34,000 to 40,000, gets 22 to 29 miles to the gallon. Reliability is very good. Satisfaction is good. Other good years were 2012 to 2016. The RX has continued to win owner loyalty over the years by delivering a luxurious driving experience, along with the strongest reliability records for any vehicle. The smooth V6 and 8-speed automatic give ample power and commendable 22 miles per gallon, while the 450-horsepower hybrid gets an excellent 29 miles per gallon. I'm sorry, the 450H, not horsepower. All 2017 RXs come standard with FCW, AEB, and adaptive cruise control. The Honda 2017 CR-V, 22,000 to 28,000, 27 to 28 miles per hour, good reliability, okay satisfaction. The CR-V is appealing because of the design for 2017, which included the addition of a turbo four-cylinder, made it better. It took to curves with more vigor, gained a more compliant ride, an upgraded cabin, and better fuel economy. Higher trims and four-way lumbar adjustment for the front seats, along with Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. FCW and AEB were a standard on EX and higher trims. 2017 Highlander, trading from 26,000 to 36,000. 22 to 25 miles to the gallon, excellent reliability, good satisfaction. The Highlander has shown near bulletproof reliability for more than a decade. It's relatively easy to maneuver in urban confines thanks to its manageable size. And it's a blessed with sure-footed handling and comfortable ride. For 2017 model, the year the V6 was mated with an 8-speed automatic, returning 22 miles per gallon overall, and the hybrid got 25 miles per gallon. It also received standard FCW and AEB. Nissan, mid-size two-row SUV, 2017 Murano, trading from 20,000 to 26,000, 21 miles per gallon, good reliability, very poor satisfaction. Murano has a generous accommodation, easy access, and a well-designed infotainment system. which adds Apple CarPlay for 2017. The cabin feels luxurious like the Axis RS, but yet the Nissan costs much less. There's plenty of oomph from a powerful V6, and optional features include a surround view camera system, FCW, AEB, BSW, and rear cross traffic warning. How to finance a used car? Know your credit score. Determine your credit score before you apply for a loan will help you estimate the interest rate you can expect to pay if you plan to finance the purchase. You'll also be able to spot the offered rate. Perhaps the dealer-arranged financing is too high. Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion are the three big credit agencies that can provide your credit score. Get pre-qualified. Once you've figured out which car you want to buy, apply for a loan with your bank or credit union. The dealer may or may not offer better terms, but it's best to have financing secured so that you have a baseline before you begin negotiations. And if possible, pay cash. Private sellers almost prefer you to get the full amount in cash. But if you're buying from a dealer, don't mention how you're paying until you've settled a price. Some dealers anticipate marking up the financing they offer to pad their profit. Paying the full amount in cash, using a bank or cashier's check, for example, will save you money or interest. How to inspect a used car? The best protection to pay a professional mechanic to inspect a used vehicle before you buy. No matter what, check the following. Vehicle history report. Always review the vehicle history report to check for accidents and major repairs. Carfax.com, AutoCheck.com are two reliable paid services. VinCheck from the National Insurance Crime Bureau, NICB.org/VinCheck is free. Body. Check body panels carefully for dents, scratches, rust, bubbles, and dull paint. Look for paint on parts that aren't supposed to be painted, which indicates prior damage and bodywork. Tires. Look for an uneven wear that might indicate hard usage or lax maintenance. Access tread depth to determine if you'll need the replacements. 4/32 inch deeper or less means it's time to buy the new tires. Suspension. Push down on each corner of the vehicle to see if the shocks or struts are worn. If they are, the vehicle may bounce up and down rather than settle. Listen for harsh bumps when taking your test drive. Under the hood. Check the belts and hoses damage for damage. Look for fluid leaks. Ask for service records to be sure the car was well maintained. Glass. Look for chips and cracks in the windshield and other windows. Infotainment system. Sit in the vehicle and make sure you can pair with the car's Bluetooth. Try Android Auto or Apple CarPlay, along with audio, climate control, and other functions to ensure that they all work correctly. Track intelligence. What a dash cam can do for you. Dash cams provide visual evidence that could clear you in case of a collision or erroneously issue speeding ticket. They can also manage the driving of a newly licensed teen, record police interactions, and assist in settling insurance claims. Image quality. A premium model with 4K resolution and image stabilization may capture license numbers and other details well, be worth the investment. Rear-facing camera. These can record activity in the cabin, document rear-end collisions, and serve as a backup camera. Data. GPS coordinates and speed data can be valuable evidence if you're wrongly charged with a moving violation. We tried out 3 dash cams and a smartphone dash cam app. Below, our observations will help you choose the best model for you. The Leo Baba. Price paid, $29. What we liked. This inexpensive model list features similar to much more expensive cameras, including a 1080 resolution, 170-degree viewing angle, and a super night vision system. What we didn't like. As with many low-cost models, it did not live up to its promise. Recordings looked out of focus, and performance at night in bright sunlight was poor. The menus were challenging to work through, and even the mounting bracket was frustrating to use. Chateau front and rear dash cam. Price paid, $70. What we liked. An included rear camera can also serve as a backup camera template with guidelines. Setup for the windshield-mounted cam is simple, and video quality is good enough to read license plate numbers when stopped. What we didn't like, image resolution when moving and at night was too poor to record in detail, making it unreliable for recording while driving. NextBase 622 GW 4K dash cam, $400. What we liked, with 4K resolution, image stabilization, and a built-in polarizer, the next day produces imaging crisp enough to make out fine details like license plates even when in motion. We also like being able to upload video clips to the cloud and an optional service that alerts authorities if the driver senses a crash. What we didn't like, at this price, we'd like a rear-facing camera included. driver dash cam and roadside app. Price paid is free. What we liked. This app for both Apple and Android smartphones has simultaneous forward and driver-facing recording and detailed trip reporting, including hard braking and acceleration, and real-time speed at each point in the video. What we didn't like, image taken with our iPhone 11 Pro did not capture fine detail at higher speeds. And let's close out with a few interesting facts. News travels fast now. These days it takes only a millisecond for info to travel 1,000 miles. But how long would it have taken in post-past modes of communication? By foot messengers. This is 1,000 miles, by the way. 11 days, 20 hours. In 1986, Stu Middleton set a record for an endurance run of 1,000 miles while averaging 3 hours of sleep per night. By carrier pigeon, 1 day and 10 hours. Wayne Jr. established the record for a 1,000-mile race in 1927, 122 yards per minute. His record still stands today. By telegraph, 3 minutes. A skilled telegraph operator could send about 16 words per minute in 1850. Thus, a 50-word tidbit of celebrity gossip would have taken about 3 minutes. Switchboard phone call, 40 seconds. In 1930, an experienced operator could gather the call information, fill in the record ticket, look up the route number, and plug in the appropriate cables to connect a long-distance call in less than a minute. Quotable quotes. You got to find something to laugh about at least once a day, be it a dopey cat video or a dad joke. That's from Whoopi Goldberg. Success is like sugar. It's too wonderful, and it burns up very quickly. Failure is like corned beef hash. It takes a while to digest, but it stays with you. Mel Brooks. Laughter, the best medicine. An optimist and pessimist spend a week together on a tropical island. Isn't this ocean just amazing, the optimist says? The endless horizon, the crashing waves, the soft sand. It makes you appreciate the beauty of our planet. But the pessimist says, I don't think that rescue plane saw us. I wonder if Sally's parents were like, yeah, great idea, Sally. Sell seashells on the seashore, where there are tons of free shells. The idiot. Watching soccer is like watching grass grow with soccer players in the way. Lauren was lying in bed one night when she felt her husband's hand caressing her neck. Then it slid down her side, stopping her knee, which was as far as her husband could reach. Then he moved closer and did the same on the other side before abruptly stopping and moving away. Delighted by this unexpected attention, Lauren whispered, Honey, that was wonderful. Why did you stop? He answered, I found the remote. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So